Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thank you for being here. It means a lot to me. This show is here as a statement of my thought, as a recreation of the many human philosophies that have existed. Originality may or may not be plausible when it comes to the strict sense of the word, but we all can consistently be platforms for past information or ideas or ways of being. And even though I feel that most of what I speak about is repurposed from the past, I still find it pertinent, intriguing, and useful. So, I speak about a lot of dead ideas from a lot of dead people. I often tell people that if they haven't been deceased for about 100 years, it's most likely that I'm not aware of them. I don't spend a lot of time with pop culture or current events, and I find that I typically maintain a very optimistic approach towards living and the way that I perceive and approach my fellow human beings in our grand systemic societies. I find that our race is full of a capacity for compassion and for an ability to love each other and to love our planet, because with our ability to reason and our use of the intellect, we have the ability to take in the entire world and put it within our grasp of love. We have that abstract ability to care for everything. And that's because of our ability to rationalize and to even attempt to think about everything. There's a scene in The Hitchhiker's Guide, probably book 2 or 3, where the dude who has the third arm that comes out of his stomach, he gets imprisoned. And as a way for them to punish him, he is forced to witness and to watch the entire universe. And the shtick is that trying to look at everything and trying to perceive everything will drive a person mad and one will lose their mind. But to have that grand approach, to be courageous and curious, is our badge of honor. It is our burden and our cross to bear in being human. By far the most curious creatures that I can fathom on our planet are human. And so I want to embrace this core of our being, our curiosity, and I want to acknowledge its contagious element and its ability to spread from one individual to another in a viral pattern very quickly. And I want to encourage that act. And I might call that inspiration. And I want people to inspirate themselves and each other. And by being inspiring, it's simply just the modeling of our own curiosity, whether or not the other has any interest in what we are pursuing. Ideas are objects. Ideas are not part of who we are. and have any more and have even more distance from our inner being and our core self than even the personality that we drape over ourselves in the form of mental fugue and clothing. Ideas are creations of man to help conceptualize and categorize the events and happenings and happenstance that we find ourselves within that may be purely chaos. Within that chaos forms patterns, and we use our empirical evidence to make further predictions based upon patterns. Yet, none of this pattern building or the blocks that we use to empiricize it have anything to do with real reality or who we are, even though it can be used to describe sections and segments of who we are. But who we are, to me, is a totality, is a complete whole. And there is the chance that in totality we exist with our world within the universal natural order of what is, as an inherent participant in the isness. A metaphor I've used in the past is the cooperation of cells in our own biology to make our being and our mass, within which I have my own concept of an ego and a self that I control and manipulate and navigate through my physical world using this physical vessel. Yet, even then, I am a mass of cooperative life energy. I have trillions and quadrillions of different specialized cells and materials in my body that all work together in mass without my conscious control or effort to keep me alive. And I don't even know what my pinky finger is thinking right now. You know, I may be rash and that may be sarcastic when I make that approach, but what if we are just cells in a larger subjective entity? And I know this is repetitive because I start every show with a bend of this message, but this is the basis that I'm approaching my optimism from. When I look at humanity and when I philosophize through my own studies and my own introspective inside journey, my base principle is that I belong in my world and that I'm seeking to form some sort of system of meaning for me that makes it so that I can have the best relationship with my world. And my world constitutes everything outside of me, which would be the subjective whole of me-ness. And outside of me is everything else. And I want to have a good relationship with everything else. And that starts with that form of curiosity. So let's get curious and let's further inquire into what beingness is. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot this week is a concept called synchronicity. And this word shows up in a lot of hoodoo hippie circles. And if you ever actually listen to me, I'm not the most hoodoo. I'm quite skeptical, and I carry a lot of doubt towards heavily organized human thought, which every individual has this discriminative nature, this ability to think and reason. But when we are given our source material, which is an initial perception, something happens to us, we perceive it with our sense data, we have an initial instinctive intuitive response to that initial spot in time when the thing happened. And from there, we build on it and we chew on it with our reason and we rationalize, and often we start predicting and we form a lot of imagination that is built from the source material. But this spreads past just our own little experimentation and philosophical process. What happens is the group mind begins to discriminate and to chew upon reality, really. And all of a sudden, we begin to trust outside information, which I'm not saying is inherently a bad thing. And I am, to myself, seeking information from the outside, and I'm trying to validate it for me. But what happens is that the discriminative nature and what we are willing to accept as truth about reality becomes easier once that idea has been imbued in society over time, which is heavily seen in the scientific process. Science is a cumulative and a team sport, and scientists depend upon the work and the computations of generations before them to even get to the point where they're studying their specific area of scientism. So, yet again, I'm not saying that all thought is bad, but I'm wary when I'm given a thought of discriminative nature that seems to be societalized and just seems to be accepted because it's the dominant narrative. And of course, this is the seed of conspiratorial thinking, and this is why conspiracy theorists have no doubt in any narrative, which I do have a lot of trust in some narratives. So I've seen this word synchronicity come up in a lot of different narratives, but from what I've seen and what I've used of this word in my own dictatorial process is that synchronicity is when things seem to align serendipitously. This is another big, long word to approach this difficult subject. But sometimes, have you ever been thinking about somebody and you'll run into them out of the blue and they'll just show up out of nowhere? And then all of a sudden, it's like you manifested them into reality. You ever been looking for a job and had to look very briefly before the first job came in, immediately fitting your wishes and what you needed to succeed in that time period? Have you ever needed money and an opportunity, or somebody came of a very helpful nature to give you exactly what you needed? And it doesn't seem to just be an explanation of purely just luck. And in my viewing of the world, everything just seems to be luck, because luck seems to just be another word for chaos for me. But sometimes things just line up when they're supposed to. And it could be the opposite too, where sometimes just the worst happens in a Murphy's Law style fashion, where things, the worst thing possible can happen as well. But in a lot of ways, I think this fuels the conspiracy of the simulation for some. If anybody knows the storyline of movies like The Matrix, where we live in a world built of programs, and then there might be a truer world than this one outside of the programs we are fed. Plato had a very good allegory concerning a cave and some captive people viewing their world through a screen of shadows. I've told this allegory several times, and if you do wish to, I'm sure you can go in probably to the first third of this show and find it somewhere in those episodes where I tell a fuller form of that one. But I do see that when I relinquish my need for control and my stranglehold of coercion when I'm trying to manipulate my future, and when I let go and I begin to sink back into some system of faith. You know, and I don't have a faith in God, but I have a faith in my life and my interactions with isness, with this world. And as I begin to relinquish that stranglehold, things serendipitously, or the synchronicities, begin to become more frequent, where I feel luckier. And on the side of that, there's also Murphy's Law rearing its heavy head, showing me chaos and its crazy laugh. So that's my question to you on the front, and my first little question here. Have you ever noticed things happen when you needed them to? Have you ever just felt like you had drank in a vial of good luck juice and you just had your day and you were feeling it? You know that it. Think about it. Did you ignore it when you had that good day and took it for granted? You know? And I think it has to do partially with the approach and our attitude. And that, like some sick reverse psychology, the harder we hold on and the more we try to force it, you know, the more and more we see how little control we have over anything. Because none of us, even the most powerful king, has any real control over the true consequences of life, which is sickness, illness, suffering, sadness, depression, and eventually death, which is bound for all of us. None of us have a damn bit of control when it comes to anything in our lives, despite some semblance of control through decision making. So in a very Buddhist or very Taoist approach, I wonder what happens when we stop fighting the current, the river of life that is pulling us towards that entropy of time that we can step out of and step into an awe-filled moment of just being. And being has nothing to do with doing, even though doing has its place. And we're all going to have to do shit constantly until we do find ourselves in that death point. So imagine that river, and imagine those rapids of chaos, of lack of control, and imagine how tired you would be if you were struggling to get out of the rapids, only to get to the edge to find that on the edge of those rapids is just an infinity of rapids forever, because there is no boundary to the river of time and life that we are born into. There is no ability to pull ourselves out of it. That can only be death. And I'm convinced that life is sarcastic enough that if we forced ourselves out of it in that way, you know, I have no way to make any sort of actual judgment on what happens after death. But I know that I would rather die in life than taking myself out of it. Not as an encouragement or anything. I've often lived in some weird idolization of the ability to choose death. And then my son came into this world and completely took all of that choice away from me. And I used to be mad because of my feelings of being stuck, because of my inescapable responsibility in my life as a single father and as a source of love and security for my precious little being. And so I no longer have any sort of choice on the matter because I'm responsible. So I sat and I used to know those feelings and idolations of that choice. But I think part of being is living with our currents and our rapids. There is a Taoist parable about that same river, where if you put a hollow object, a boat or a ball, you know, and I always picture it as like a bright red, silly ass ball, kind of like a rubber buoy you sometimes find, like that same color on fishing rods, used to be highly evident and highly visual, you know, just so I could see it going up and down in the currents in my mind's eye. You know, the ball just floats down and has absolutely no intentions in or out, and probably chooses the best way through the rapids possible, even though it has no choice about the matter. And at the end of the day, you become the river, and life's rapids become who you are because the ball disappears. So to become rapids, to have constant change in our objective subjectivity. And this is something I've been thinking a lot about this week as well, which is this concept that I think of as uncomfortability. And I've heard a lot of men say it throughout my life as a young man growing up, receiving words of wisdom or some sort of verbal lesson to increase my maturity. And I don't even think it has to be with being a man. It might just be becoming an adult. But I've often heard that you can't learn anything while you're comfortable. And it's that comfortability that leads to complacency. And now, often I have been a preacher of contentment. And I would also like to argue that you can be content while being uncomfortable. And part of being able to swallow uncomfortability is learning how to become content with it. Because if anyone wants to better themselves or to seek or to find anything or to look life dead in the face and stop running away from what we are currently doing and being able to accept our place in life in its suffering is to be knowledgeable and aware of that uncomfortability that's inherent in that. And what happens a lot of times is that people run away from challenge and they run away from the synchronicities that are being put in place in front of us by this mother world, which may be based in chaos, like I've said many times throughout the show. But we can't run away from all of these opportunities. Challenge is a doorway to the next moment. And the handle of the doorway is our choice and our decision to be with it, to grit our teeth and to love our uncomfortability, to embody what it means to struggle, to fully capitalize on our humanity and our inner strengths and potential that can only shine and show their luster through being forged in the fire and becoming the steel of who we really are. So I want more people to walk into uncomfortability and to not feel guilty for being challenged. Having challenge in our lives doesn't mean that we're incapable. It doesn't mean that we're weak. It doesn't mean that we don't have potential. Having challenge is being human and being part of who every single participant in society is having to incur. Even some other that we can look up to and desire what they have, we cannot sit inside their mind and their perspective, and we cannot carry their baggage because they may be carrying difficulties that they cannot translate into our perception, and they cannot translate it into our way so that we can see their struggle. But another's struggle is never as heavy or comparable to our struggle. We're all carrying bags, but my baggage is no heavier than yours, and yours is no heavier than theirs. So, be strong. Don't pity yourself. Because I see an immensely divine creation of life sitting here on the other end of that microphone listening to me. And I think that you are incredible. I think that you are impressive. And I think that you have the capacity to change the microcosm of other beings that are in your closer circles. And that we can create an infectious change in our world that I think is already happening. And I think that you can be the optimum version of who you want to be, no matter how hard it is. So thank you for waking up this morning. Thank you for taking all these hundreds of breaths just to support all your unconscious and non-voluntary organs that keep you breathing and keep you walking. Thank you for doing all those hard jobs. And thank you for loving you, and thank you for loving all those around you. I can't tell you how much how grateful I am to have this opportunity to speak with you guys. And if you ever want to reach out to me, you can send me any questions or any opinions that you have about any subject matter on any of my shows. And that'll be to the gingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. That's a very long email address, I know, so it's very available in the show notes that you can just click on it and copy and paste, and we can get to talking. And if you have a good question, I'd love to put it on the show, and I'd love to make you a part of this creative process. So thank you so much for being here for that. I'm going to go grab a good book. We're going to do a little bit of quotations from some history. So I read from this one last week too, but I've been finding it very pertinent and heavy and impactful in my own life and my own studies for whatever I'm seeking. So here goes. This is from D.T. Suzuki's Zen Buddhism, selected writings, roughly towards the end of the book. This is from some discussions of the unconscious, very close to the bits that I shared last week as well. It's a great book. Please look into D.T. Suzuki if you have any interests into Buddhism or Zen. I think it can be helpful for your own journey as well. So this is Chapter 3, Samando, which are questions and answers in the form of dialogue. Illustrating no mind. A monk asked Chi of Yunchu of the 8th century, "What is meant by seeing into one's self nature and becoming a Buddha?" Chi replies, "This nature is from the first, pure and undefiled, serene and undisturbed. It belongs to no categories of duality, such as being and non-being, pure and defiled, long and short, taking in and giving up. The body remains in its suchness. To have clear insight into this is to see into one's own self-nature. Self-nature is the Buddha, and the Buddha is self-nature. Therefore, seeing into one's own self-nature is becoming the Buddha." The monk asks, "If self-nature is pure and belongs to no categories of duality, such as being and non-being, etc., where does this seeing take place?" Chi, "There is a seeing, but nothing is seen." Monk, "If there is nothing seen, how can we say that there is anything seeing at all?" Chi, "In fact, there is no trace of seeing." Monk, In such a seeing, who is seeing it? She, there is no seer either. Second dialogue. A monk asked Ching Sin of Changsha, what is meant by one's everyday thought is the Tao? Ching Sin, when I feel sleepy, I will sleep. When I want to sit, I sit. Monk, I fail to follow you. Ching Sin, in summer, we seek a cool place. When cold, we sit by a fire. Dialogue 3. A Vinaya master called Yuan came to Tai Chu Hoiha and asks, when disciplining oneself in the Tao, is there any special way of doing it? Hu Hai says, yes, there is. Yuan asks, what is that? Hoi Hai, when hungry, one eats. When tired, one sleeps. Yuan asks, that is what other people do. Is their way the same as yours? Hoi Hai replies, not the same. Yuan, why not? Hoi Hai, when they eat, they do not just eat. They conjure up all kinds of imagination. When they sleep, they do not just sleep. They are given up to varieties of idle thoughts. That is why theirs is not my way. Qinlong came up to Shi Tu and asked, what is the idea of Dharma's coming over here from the west? Shi Tu, ask that post over there. Qinlong, I do not understand. Shi Tu, neither do I. This remark made by Qinlong realizes the truth. Later, when a monk came to him asking for his instructions, he called out, O Reverend Sir, the monk answered, yes. Whereupon, Qinlong says, you are turning away from yourself. If so, why do you not see to it that I behave properly? This said, Qinlong wiped his eyes as if trying to see better. The monk had no words. Dialogue 5. When Yao Shan Wei Yin was sitting cross-legged quietly, a monk came to him and said, in this immovable disposition, what are you thinking? Yao Shan, thinking of that which is beyond thinking. Monk, how do you go on with thinking that which is beyond thinking? Yao Shan, by not thinking. Dialogue 6. A monk asked Yao Shan to enlighten him. As he was still groping in the dark as to the meaning of his own life, Yao Shan kept quiet for a while. This keeping quiet is pregnant with meaning, and if the monk were ready for it, he could have comprehended what made Yao Shan remain silent. But in point of fact, the monk failed, and Yao Shan continued. It is not difficult for me to say a word to you on the matter before us. The point, however, is to grasp the meaning. As soon as it is uttered, without a moment of deliberation, when this is done, there is an approach to the truth. On the other hand, there is a delay on your part, and you begin to reason things out, and the fault will be finally laid at my door. It is, after all, better to keep the mouth closed so that we both escape further complications. Dialogue 7. Chang'e Hongyin, a disciple of Matsu, was once asked by Yuan Shan, how can one see into one's own self-nature? Chang'e said, it is like a cage with six windows, and there is in it a monkey. When someone calls at the east window, oh monkey, oh monkey, he answers. At the other window, the same response is obtained. Yang Shan thanked him for the instruction and said, your instructive simile is quite intelligible, but there is one thing on which I wish to be enlightened. If the inside monkey is asleep, tired out, what happens when the outside one comes to interview it? Chang'e got down on a straw seat and, taking Yang Shan's arm, began to dance, saying, oh monkey, oh monkey, my interview with you is finished. It is like an animalcule making its nest among the eyebrows of a mosquito. It comes out at the street crossing and makes a loud cry. Wide is the land, few are the people, and one rarely meets friends. All right. I know a lot of that's very confusing. I still barely know what it means to me. but I do feel that it has something to do with the root message of what I've been investigating over the presentness. So thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you got something out of my discourse tonight. So how about we end by asking Odin his opinion on how his life is faring?
1 times 1. 10.
No, that's what you did last week. What are you up to, man? That's really loud and you're gonna hurt it.
I'm not really doing anything. I was just planning to do it.
What were you playing?
I wasn't playing anything.
Well, you're playing Xbox right now. Why?
I wasn't playing Xbox.
Why do you like Xbox?
I don't like Xbox.
Why do you like YouTube?
I don't like YouTube.
So I guess he's gonna say negative things about anything I say. But I'm sure all of you know that he is actually obsessed with Xbox and obsessed with YouTube.
Okay. Dyer, is there any way today can I'm going to try to say to you, Emma, yeah, my favorite thing in the world is Xbox?
Sure.
So there actually is, so they can just type it in.
Probably.
So whoever thinks I am obsessed with Xbox, well, they might know if they type it in and let us know.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your time, buddy.
Yeah.
I love you.
Love you.
You want to go back to what you're doing?
Yeah.
Okay. Bye. Bye. Say bye. Okay.
Bonito.